So here we are talking about mushrooms for another episode of Earth Life. I'm here from the middle of a cloud in Maine. It's been misting and raining for days, which is very good news for our chanterelles. And I'm connecting across the world with Juan, who has just come back from the mountains in Oaxaca. Welcome to you, Juan. Will you introduce yourself?
Hi, Sabrine. First of all, thank you very much for the invitation. Yes, I'm Juan. I'm a chef based in Mexico City. I'm interested in education, research, and gastronomy. My current project called Sexto is a research-based culinary project in which we want to explore the gastronomy and food, and also to educate and do research. I'm very interested in a variety of topics, but mainly in food aesthetics, wild mushrooms, wild seafood, and fermentation mainly.
We have similar interests. The places where civilization, anthropology, cultivation, wildcrafting, nature reverence, and beauty collide.
Yeah.
And so tell us, when you're working this very intersectional way, you're seducing your audience and you're growing a community of practice. Maybe just dive into the process or how the practice happens by telling about your trip to the mountains.
When we started the project, we really didn't know how to achieve this intersection between all these disciplines we explore. So we started by just exploring whatever was in front of us, like wild mushrooms, art, philosophy, anything, bread, even, and many topics. But then we realized that we needed to get deeper into fewer topics so we could do like proper research and communicate this like efficiently. So after a couple of trials, we decided to set three main research topics. The first one is the seafood, wild seafood in Mexico. The second one is indigenous Mexican ferments, and the third one is wild mushrooms. We explore also corn, but we are just starting with corn. So like 1 year ago, Osvaldo, we are now friends with Osvaldo, but Oaxacan guy from the mountains in Oaxaca reached us to start a collaboration on wild mushrooms. He's from an indigenous community called Mixtecs or Mixtecos in Spanish. And actually, the name in Mixtec language is called Ñu Sabi, which translate like the people of the rain. It rains like crazy every day and every time there. So that's why they have a lot of mushrooms too. So he reached us, and we decided to start not just an exploration about the biology or the diversity of wild mushrooms, which was our first interest, but also to include the relationship built between culture and the culture between this indigenous group and the consumption of wild mushrooms. So that's why we just visited for the first time this place in Oaxaca, and it was really great.
And so the we that you have is a growing community of people who are all somehow learning together and following a curriculum together.
Yes.
Deepening the learning and embrace of these different traditions, the land races, the cultivation practices. With a wild mushroom, I wonder, is there anything that is done beyond knowing where they are and chasing them? Like, is there anything in terms of habitat modification that you were learning about?
Yes. Well, when I talk about we, is because the project is an interdisciplinary project. So far, like the core group, we are five. We are all from very different disciplines. I was trained as a computational biologist, but then turned to be a cook. I always wanted to be a cook. And then we have also people coming from finance or anthropology or sustainability and communication. So we are like a very diverse group. But then we have an extended community. And this extended community includes all of our collaborators, artists, philosophers, scientists, many cooks, photographers. So, and then like the people like Osvaldo, who is a biologist, and the person in charge of the project of this wild mushroom project. So yes, actually when we went there and we met like a lot of people involved in getting to know the relationship between the forest and the consumption of not only wood but also mushrooms and wild plants.
And you are describing also the relationship that is forming with your kind of intersectional learning community, but that you're also watching each other and tuning to each other and learning to tune into the habitat in a new way, and looking differently together and seeing each other in the looking differently. It sounds like it's almost like an alternative school.
Yeah, exactly. We are really committed to look at nature, or look at food, look at nature or through food. So in this way, we are trying to use like alimentation or gastronomy as a tool for learning about the world in an interdisciplinary way. And yes, we have learned a lot from each other, from the core group, and also from our extended community. It has been a long ride now, but very enriching.
And so you were talking about the kinds of mushrooms that you were looking at and the kinds of habitat where they're growing. And I wondered if you were learning about how the wild spaces interact with domestic spaces, or the connection between the ferments, which are contained, and then the wild occurring mushrooms, if there's any dialogue between those, that kind of like, it's not a frontier, but it's various shades of human interference.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because I think there is like a very long, very strong link between wild mushroom consumption and human practices. So far, we have done like a really deep research into this interaction. Well, not quite deep, but like we've been reading about the topic like for 3 or 4 months, and we have learned that the fact that you can be eating like a chanterelle or a porcini without the fear of becoming intoxicated or even poisoned is because there is a strong human mushroom relationship behind. And it's a a relationship that has been built for hundreds, if not thousands of years. In the case of indigenous Mexican communities, there are a lot of information and pre-Hispanic information about this relationship. This relationship is mainly about hallucinogenic mushrooms, but I am sure there is a lot more about this and information to be discovered. So I think, like, especially in the Mixtec region, there is a codex called the Vindobonensis Codex, and it tells the story about the creation of the Mixtec culture and the origin of the universe, and there are a lot of gods interacting in one space. And one of these gods, well, the main one of two of these gods, very interesting ones, are the goddess of the pulque, or this fermented beverage made from agave, and also the mushroom goddess. So that's why we know so far there has been like a really strong relationship. But now you can see it in their practices. They eat mushrooms like every day for breakfast and for dinner or for the main meal. So when they go to take care of the milpa, which is this agricultural system in a pre-Hispanic agricultural system in which they grow corn, beans, squash, and other green plants. On the way from their home to the field, they are picking mushrooms, like the mushrooms they like. They put them on a bag, and then back home they cook them.
It strikes me as I'm listening, the tuning in. You know, this program is about tuning in to Earth life, and especially in a time of Corona when so many people are stuck inside the house and tuning into television and media and fear and kind of existential panic about humanity's course on Earth. The challenge or the project to tune into nature, to the life of the Earth, is kind of our inquiry here. And when you talk about the people who are walking back and forth from their home where the fire is and the warmth and the safety through the forest to the milpa, what you are evoking in me is a remembrance that these indigenous agricultural systems, which are everywhere on Earth to be found in so many thousands and thousands of ways, an expression of human inquiry and deep observation of Earth life, the project of discovering what's possible now from the land now, what the land is saying now, is something that we as humans have a very ancient practice of doing, and we may even be capable still now of listening. And so a lot of the practice and a lot of the project for those of us who are interested to be listening seems like is remembering how much a collaboration with the wild it is to domesticate, that these domesticated systems arose in the context of self-willed systems, and that the self-willed systems were always present with the systems that interacted with human will over millennia and millennia. And I think sometimes there's an idea that engineering and the force of the marketplace or an approach to scaling or replicating and much of the kind of clinical and prognostication around agricultural systems discourse in the media, in business, in the marketplace, in the investor world, in the world of climate science, is very much on a different track of thinking from the very simple, very ancient question, where are we? What's happening here? What does the land produce on which I live? How do I live with the land on which I live?
Well, there are a lot of things that I want to reflect on, but I think first, in Mexico specifically, we have a problem with the scalability. After NAFTA, a lot of people were forced to leave their indigenous food waste to incorporate into an scalable system. So they could no longer afford the having their own cornfields or their milpas, and they had to move to the city and start to generate money or even migrate to the United States. They could no longer compete with the gigantic amounts of corn that were produced elsewhere, rather in Mexico or even in these indigenous communities. So yes, there is a lot of effort right now in Mexico City mainly of getting in contact with these communities who are keeping with this ancient or indigenous food waste. So we could learn from them and also take a little bit from their knowledge and bring it to the city, starting by just knowing about them and eating their products. Their products are like remarkably delicious. And also, there is a situation about diversity. We are losing a lot of diversity. We have a problem about losing indigenous corn varieties. There is a lot of competition from the hybrids, corns coming from gigantic firms. So one of the efforts of Sexto, and also I believe from a very young generation of cooks and gastronomers, is to promote the biological diversity of ingredients. I think if we embrace the idea that you can get specific, you can attack specific things about alimentation with specific varieties of corn or specific varieties of many ingredients, we can get healthier, but also we will be helping to have like more healthy ground or more healthy natural resources. Especially in the Mixtec region in Oaxaca, they have a pine and oak forest. They get wood, timber from the forest, and they have a very interesting perspective about consuming wood. Although we saw many like land areas, devastated land areas, they were aware that they had to reestablish the forest there. And also, it was interesting that they said, the grandmother said that if they keep on doing this like high-end wood or timber extractions, the earth gets scared and won't produce more delicious mushrooms or delicious food anymore. So they have like in their tradition, a really strong commitment to their land and to their forest. And I think that's something very important and helpful to think about and to bring into the cities, to learn that we have to reestablish some kind of connection, not like a real connection with diversity and with, and from my perspective, with flavor also. If you have diversity, you have a lot of flavor.
You're using your senses as a chef, and the seduction of the taste, which is an ancient human impulse and something we can trust. It's almost like there's a wild inside our mouth, inside our brain, that it knows more than we as civilized, wage-earning, rent-paying, highly mobile internet users know. And it feels like one of the things that the portal of the taste is letting you explore and experience is how this is embedded in a different approach to the land and land ownership and land care. You're talking about the harvesting in the pine forest. I wonder, could you give a little explanation? You have done so about the milpas, which are pre-Hispanic agroecological system that people can, we'll put some links in the program so people can go learn. But will you talk about the ejido system? Because I know that the pine sap and the gentle harvest of these community-owned lands is a long, long-standing and very durable ecological practice that would be wonderful for more people to know about.
Yeah, so about the milpa, right?
The ejido.
Ah, okay, ejido, yeah. Well, ejido was a system of shared land mainly on indigenous communities outside Mexico City, which was established, I think, during the 30s by Lázaro Cárdenas. This was a project which wanted to give back some of the land lost by many of the indigenous communities, that the indigenous communities lost before independence, the revolution, sorry, the war of revolution. So Lázaro Cárdenas established this ejido system. So a group of indigenous people could share a common space, and they could grow corn and especially milpa. So I think there is a situation about ownership in right now, because for me, I live in the city. My grandmother used to be part of an ejido, and I grew up like from 4 to 12 in eating from this system. But this is something you can unlearn very easy. When you go to the school, and when you go to the university, and the entire system based on the city, there is nothing like common ownership. There is a lot of a strong sense of individuality, and I think that happened before that, but we lost this common sense of ownership. And something very beautiful from the Mixtec culture, and that something that I can remember from my childhood, is you can get into the house of one of the persons of these communities and eat from what they are cooking. The people from the community go in and out from their homes and share all the products, and they share their times and their work, and it's something very that inspired me and made me remember about this system that I used to live also during my childhood.
The project is remembering,
yeah,
how to be a collective.
Yeah.
and that part of that collective is the land itself, and that the land has a voice and we can listen. It wouldn't be fair not to talk a little bit specifically about the mushrooms that you're bringing into your cooking, because if we have a chef on the show, we better do a little bit of recipe talk.
Yeah. You wanna...
it's wonderful to think with you, and then to make you also bring out your pots and pans, it's almost unfair. But tell me, what are you cooking, and do you also have chanterelles there?
Well, there's like an outstanding diversity of wild mushrooms, especially in the southern part of Mexico City, in the highlands. We have chanterelles. We have, so far, I know, is like three kinds of chanterelles: the black chanterelle, red chanterelle, and the yellow chanterelle that we know. We also have kind of mushrooms, be like truffles. They are not quite like truffles, but they belong to the same family and they have a strong smell. We have wild, like, porcini, something like porcini. Actually, it's kind of the same species, but after a DNA analysis, they realized it's not Boletus edulis, the common porcini, but Boletus rubriceps. But well, we have, I don't know, maybe 200 varieties of mushrooms that we eat in Mexico. In this specific community, they eat 54 different varieties of mushrooms. So there is a lot. And they have a few ways to cook them. But since like last year, we started to explore white mushrooms, we cooked 12 different kinds of mushrooms, including huitlacoche, which is this parasitic mushroom which grows on corn. It's black and it's delicious.
Yeah, the smart one.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a really nice mushroom. And also, we have like something similar to matsutake mushroom. Also, it's a really delicate smell and aroma. And well, there is too much. We have like this very bright orange mushroom called like pork snout. Yeah, snout. Yeah, I think it's pork snout. And it's delicious. It tastes, it's lobster mushroom in North America. Yeah, we have a lot of that. And we cook it like in many ways. Right now in Mexico City, the cooking tradition is almost like European or Western. They cook it with a lot of butter on the wood fire. But it remembers me Europe or North America, not quite Mexico. In Mexico, we have a lot of ways of cooking mushrooms, but I don't think it's been explored so far in Mexico City or in the big cities in Mexico. But they cook it with mole, in the indigenous communities. They cook it with like on the wood fire, with in very simple ways, with a lot of aromas from onions, garlics, and coriander, for example, and it's very different. It's not what we are used to eat wild mushrooms or simple mushrooms.
Can we talk about the lobster mushroom or the chanterelle mushroom, since that's something we have in common here in our forests? We're very grateful for this rain because it's going to bring a lot of chanterelles.
Yeah. This lobster mushroom, we in Mexico, I think in the city they don't know it very much, but in the communities they eat it like in tamales. Tamales is this steamed corn masa, corn dough, nixtamalized corn dough. Nixtamalization is this process in which dried corn is cooked with limestone. And after this process of cooking, the pericarp of the seed of the corn gets soft and releases a lot of the nutrients. Then it is grounded into masa or dough, and then we use it to make tortillas, or if you add a little bit of fat, or sometimes a lot of fat, and wrap it in corn leaves or banana leaves, you can make a tamal if you steam it. So especially chanterelles and lobster mushrooms are eaten in tamales, and they're absolutely delicious.
I see a lot that you're working with the plantain bananas and cooking with those. One of the big conversations in climate adaptation is how will we grow so much food? How will we, with our simplified monocultures of globally traded commodity products, feed all these people? And obviously in the slow food movement, in the small farm movement, in the indigenous communities, the answer to that is diversity, small farms, subsistence, food traditions, and there's a much healthier, happier, more integrated way for humans to live on Earth than big tankers full of bulk dumped commodity. But obviously getting between one system to the other and strengthening the mother regions for the indigenous and small farm cultivation is many years of project involving many people. I wonder if you could talk about what are some of the parts along the journey, if we're interested to actively participate, perhaps people who are listening who've been stuck in their houses realize that fundamentally they're interested to change where they sit in the project of life, and they're maybe interested not to be sitting in a chair on a computer for the rest of their lives, and maybe they want to participate more actively in the Earth life and in Earth systems. Maybe you could talk a bit or narrate a bit. What are some of the steps that you see in Mexico for making the food economy, the food region, the food community more sustainable, more diverse, more inclusive? Healthier. What do these villages need from us who are passionate young people, and how can we participate in supporting a third way?
Yeah, sure. There's a lot, really, really lot to do. There's people who is starting already to do a lot of work on this, but I think that specifically in Mexico we have to re-evaluate or relearn about the milpa system. The milpa system allows you to grow in a very sustainable way many varieties of foods and vegetables, from corn, which might be the main one, but also beans. And the beans have the capacity to fix atmospheric nitrogen into the land, and insects like grasshoppers. I think that first of all we need to rebuild bridges between the communities who keep on living from these systems with the city. There is a lot of an ethical discourse here, because Sometimes it could get like a cultural appropriation, and it could get from something that could be beautiful to the exploitation again from these communities. So it has to be an alliance, and it has to be a collaboration, a very collaborative effort in which not only we learn from them, or we consume their products, but also give back something. So a lot of people in Mexico have indigenous roots. I could say that, for example, my grandmother still grows, not very actively, but she still grows her milpa. She has her animals just 15 minutes from here. I don't have to go into the middle of the mountains in Oaxaca to see that there is people still trying to keep with this system. Of course, you won't get tons and tons of corn or beans or some other products. You will have a bit of everything, and you will have a bit of corn and a little bit of beans and other products of insects, but just enough. So I think people need to look back to your family, to your neighbors, to your friends, and not far from you there will be people still growing and believing on these food systems.
So the point is that we have it inside us, we have it inside our own history.
Yeah.
And not to hesitate to say, this is something that's also about me, and I have to take responsibility for learning everything I can, and respecting the materials, respecting the traditions, expressing humility, but not being so afraid that we're some kind of an outsider, so that not to get involved. It's worse not to get involved, almost.
Exactly. It's worse, because if we think of these communities like some precious jewel that has to remain untouched, that would be like a death sentence for the traditions. We have to get involved in a very active collaboration with them. For many of us, might be very difficult. I don't think impossible, but very difficult to grow your own milpa. But you can buy products from people who grow milpa. So that's a very good start. In Mexico, we have nomadic markets called tianguis. So they move from one city to another, selling the products they collect all the way from their hometowns to the cities. And not all of them, but many of them still grow their own products in very sustainable ways. So you just have to do a little bit of research, specifically in Mexico, a little bit of research to know who is growing their products in a very sustainable way. And sometimes they don't even know they are growing their own products in a very sustainable way. So it can be like a discourse, and you can share the knowledge that you already know with them, and let them know that this is a very good practice, and they could get more money from what they're doing, and they could still live from these practices. There is a very serious problem in Mexico that you can get all these products from a few pesos. So it might be sustainable for the earth, but it is not sustainable for the family living from these products. So a lot of education and communication is very necessary.
So that there's another project, another work, and another collaboration is to discover how some part of the harvest from these traditional systems could earn more money by being sold for a bit more more value, more valorization in that sense. I'm thinking about New Mexico, and there's a funny situation where the young boys in the valleys who are growing with the traditional irrigation systems that were already flowing for 400 years, that were adapted from the Moors who were taught the Spanish, who came up from Mexico and came up to New Mexico. So three layers or four layers of adaptation of a irrigation technique, not the ejido, but the acequia, which is also a commons-based water-sharing arrangement. And the acequias today are still flowing, and a lot of the work is being done by young teenage boys who, a lot of the work. There's a small story of some parts of this land, which is being run by young boys who are able to sell the beautiful traditional corns in the farmer's market for a good price. They're able to, you know, eat and share in their own community that food. And they're also growing marijuana with the same irrigation water. Now, you could say, oh dear, why are these boys growing drugs and not food? You could also say, because they're interested to earn some money, they're also growing corn. And they're growing corn on the outside, so no one will see the marijuana. But, you know, whatever it takes for the tradition and the biodiversity and the knowledge to pass to the next generation and also be a viable way for the community to meet their needs. So it's almost like kind of deconstructing this precious anthropology worship of the past and saying, you know, how do we work this situation moving forward?
Exactly. Yeah. Traditions are not like these static sculptures. They're flexible, and they respond to the environment, to the political and cultural situation, to environmental situations. And we must look at traditions in this way, do something flexible. And I think something very important is to get record, or like very precise record of these things, because if there is like in the worst case scenario in which a tradition is lost, like completely lost, if you have the proper intellectual records, you can get back a little bit from it. So there is a little information from indigenous practices, and I think there is another area of opportunity in research and education to record all this ancient knowledge.
So to act in a transcription mode, that if you're someone who has a connection to a tradition like this, that it's almost like an animal who's not very many people know the animal is in the field. And so whoever knows where the animal is has to bring water.
Yeah.
And whoever knows, it's a kind of an ethics of life.
Yeah.
Whoever knows where is life that needs to be cared for, needs to care for it.
Exactly.
I was reading about epazote. I was thinking about coronavirus and the sanitization and the kind of microbial environment that's going to be caused by all this sanitizing, and how that relates to the kind of wild fermentation and the atmospheric microbial environment that we know is so healthy for young children growing up on farms to be exposed to such a healthy dirt. And I wonder, in reading about epazote, it said that it was used as a herbal water, as a washing, like seasonally people were washing their whole house with epazote water, like a tea. Is that something you heard about?
No, it's the first time I've heard about it. I know that the pasote has this antiseptic or antimicrobial activity, but didn't know about that. I'm going to read about this. But it's really interesting what you say about the environmental microbiome and how it's going to be affected by this almost obsessive or compulsory cleaning practices that has been arising from the coronavirus situation. And I think there is a lot of potential here for fermentation to be like reservoirs of this environment, because at some point this microbial colonies or systems live like everywhere, like literally everywhere, inside us, outside us, in every corner, and somehow fermentation and the basis of the fermentation is that they're like reservoirs for these microbes. So I think like for the last two decades, this topic has been growing and has been gaining a lot of interest in young generations like mine. We are obsessed with ferments. There was a lot of skeptic and accepted position from people to know the real position of these foods, fermented foods, into the human health. But now there is proof, like actual proof, that we have some of these, for example, lactic acid bacteria living inside us, or kind of training our immune system to cope with pathogenic microbes. So yes, the microbiology right now is something that we should also take a look, because with the technology we have now, we know more and more about the real position they play in our health and in our life.
So there's almost, because of this obsessive cleaning, and because so many of us are discovering the role of fermented foods in anti-inflammatory or immune health, and there's a big discourse now and more tools to evaluate the kind of human microbiome, this seems like it's a good time for a discourse and an explosion of excitement of re-inoculating ourselves after the corona wipe down.
Yeah, exactly. We, specifically because we already know with like more precisely how they work and how can we inoculate them into our foods in a responsible way. Otherwise, if you don't do it like in a responsible way, you can get sick and get your family sick. So it's not simple. It's a complex topic. It's something you have to learn about and be sensitive about. But right now, there is a lot of information.
Maybe we'll put some links in the show of the places that are these incredible places of leadership around the world, like the NOMA, Nordic Food Lab, Humans. Yeah. But do you want to talk a few other places you're learning from when it comes to the wild ferment and traditional ferment practices?
Yeah, sure.
Some of our teachers.
Yes. Actually, I learned about fermentation when I worked in NOMA. They were in 2014. They were starting their own ferment, the famous fermentation program they have now. and they brought a lot of people who knew, like even microbiologists or flavor scientists like Ariel Johnson, chefs like David Silver were working there at the same time, and they explored not only local fermentations, but also fermentation from all around the world, like Japan or even like Mexico. In Mexico, we have pulque, which is a fermented beverage made from agave, which is delicious. I find it delicious. A lot of people don't really like it. It's like, it's not for everybody, but I think it's amazing. And I learned also, when I studied biology, I learned a lot of about the role of microbes in fermented foods from my microbiology classes, in a high throughput perspective, from DNA sequencing of thousands of species of microorganisms living inside us and living in the environment. So yes, I think there's a lot of information right now. Traditional information about fermented foods, it's getting also like it's getting on the internet. On Instagram, every day I find more and more people who are making really interesting projects on food fermentation, like Pascal Baldar the Noma fermentation project also.
The last thing I cannot resist asking you about is the fish sauce, because the person who connected us is Paul Molyneux, who is a researcher of small fisheries around the world. He comes to Mexico City. He's a thinker of the commons. He's a strong conservation-minded man. He believes in subsistence fisheries, fishery traditions. And he was one of the ones who encouraged us to think about the fish that happens in our rivers and in our bays here in Maine in these terms. And basically, because of him and because of the chef from Portland who came to visit, we started making fish sauce, fermented fish sauce from the heads, from the guts, from the whole bodies of different fish. And I wonder if you can talk as a chef about the role of this very traditional food in Southeast Asia, very traditional in Italian, Roman, and ancient civilizations of the Mediterranean basin. Has this fish sauce also a role in traditional Mexican cooking or in your cooking?
In traditional Mexican food cooking, so far I know, there is no something similar. Somehow, I don't know if it's because we have a lot of diversity and resources inland, we don't have to look into the sea. Actually, in Mexico City, we don't have like a strong seafood traditions like in Japan or in the Mediterranean. But in my cooking, we really like the flavor, this potent and strong aroma from garum or from fishes. And we are trying to make our own, actually. We have done a little bit of research about it. We know that some of the enzymes that start the fermentation come from the liver of the species, of the fishes, but also there are some species you have to avoid, like this species that come from the tuna or campachi or this jack family fishes you have to avoid, because they generate like very toxic compounds when fermented.
Well, we've been cooking, we've been doing it more with oily fish.
Yes, exactly.
Like mackerel and pollock and river herring. And we had very delicious flavors. It's basically 20% salt. And yeah, also we were told to use the guts of the fish. And we shake it, we push it down under the salt brine, we shake it, we push it down under the salt brine, and then we filter it 3-4 times with also the micron bags, and then it's so delicious. I just don't know how do we prove that it's safe. That's my next project.
Yeah, I think the only way to know that it's safe is not to, is like avoid like tuna or this. It actually, those kind of fishes that are not safe to use, they are very, they're not really easy to use into fishes because they are big. They are usually big. These small oily fishes, most of them are safe to use. So, but yes, it's something that is very delicious. I love, I really like to use them. Even sometimes I cannot, I can't resist the temptation to use fishes into some of the moles or some of the traditional Mexican sauces that we sometimes prepare.
I'm emailing you now asking for your mailing address so we can send you a taste of our fish. We can send you
Yes,
some fish sauce
please.
in the mail.
Yeah, I would really love to try. We could also share with you some of the ferments we have now. We actually just ended the production of ant larvae garum.
Wow.
It smells like chocolate. It tastes like a combination of fishes, but also like soy sauce, and it has like a very unctuous or creamy texture. It's amazing.
Wow, we could do a feral trade. Do you know the Feral Trade Project?
No.
Oh, it's so wonderful. It's a international art project
Yeah.
involving many people, and basically it's smuggling food to one another.
Ah,
And
well.
it started because artists were being paid very little, but their art was being shipped for them across the world. So they started by smuggling chocolate and olive oil and coffee and cheese and like special things. Like we all smuggle a little bit of things in our suitcases. And so then it was using the infrastructure of the art world, the curators, the desks, the warehouses, the art packaging to put a trade economy inside of that art infrastructure to move these special products around. And it's a wonderful, it was especially for those of us who live in remote places. We ship away seaweed and blueberries and fish sauce and things, and we get tropical fruit and dried fruit and things from other parts of the world. And we can make our own trade routes like diasporic people always have.
Yeah, sounds amazing. We should. It sounds interesting, delicious, and also, in a way, sustainable.
Well, at least it goes by mail truck. I look forward to that, and I'm thankful for you, and I hope that some of our listeners can somehow make it to one of your famous dinners in Mexico City. Or how else could they participate in your universe?
We will launch our website in a couple of months, and we will have a blog, so you can not only read about us and our thoughts, but also share with us your thoughts about food, anything about food. We are open for any ideas there. We will start actually to sell products in at least in Mexico City from some of these indigenous communities with in a very responsible way. So you can, if you happen to live in Mexico City, soon we will start to sell like corn from the mountains in Oaxaca or some of these fantastic apples that I tasted there. A thing about apples in Mexico is that I don't really like them. I'm kind of allergic to apples, and I tried some of them in a pop-up that I did in the UK, and I thought those were the best apples I ever tried, and I thought that good apples were just like in Europe, but here in Oaxaca they have some apples that are just as fantastic as the UK ones. So we will start to trade with these products in collaboration with these indigenous communities in Oaxaca. So, and also, as soon as this coronavirus situation or the pandemic situation ends or gets not as dangerous as it is now, we will start to make dinners again. So we try to give not only delicious food, but also the background behind the food we're preparing and trying to communicate about, in this case, the wild mushroom culture behind them.
I look forward to reading more and more and more and tasting when I can get a chance. It's a beautiful discourse that you're holding, and I thank you so much for your leadership and your articulation and your compassion.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I really appreciate it. And also, well, thank you for Paul for connecting us, and really looking forward to share with you more and more. And also I hope one day we can go or you can come. You are welcome.
Thank you. Next, when we do, we can talk about fish gelatin for another hour.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, ciao, ciao.